station. And the, interestingly enough, the music department at ENC also contributed to this, conference. And also the generous support here at BC for the Center for Christian Jewish Learning, the Jesuit Institute, the Boston College Magazine, and the Winston Center for Leadership and Ethics. On a more personal note, I want to single out a couple of people who this conference would not have happened without them. Charles Hayes for inspiring me to think about these ideas and going to his website, and I encourage you all to do that. And Eric Owens, the assistant director of Bozzi Center, and his persistence and organizational skills that are evident today, and his determination has made this conference possible. Let me explain how it will work this afternoon. Very similar to this morning, each panelist will have about 10 minutes to make a presentation, and some will use audio and visual aids in their area of knowledge and experience, and the topic again is journalistic ethics in religious coverage. I may ask a few questions to begin the process. There will be an open microphone as we had this morning, and questions from the audience will be encouraged, and as I said, a microphone will be made available. Each panel member will have an opportunity to respond, and follow-up questions, of course, are encouraged. Before I introduce our impressive panel this afternoon, I want to quote a quote from Jefferson I'm sure you're all familiar with. And it is famous. If I had to choose between government newspapers, I would choose the latter. Today that quote, it seems to me, sounds almost quaint in today's internet world, where both government and newspapers have been devalued. But nevertheless, the tradition and the importance of free expression remains vital for this society. So let me begin the process by introducing first Michael Paulson, who is the religious reporter for the Boston Globe. He was a member of the Globe team of reporters who reported on the clergy sexual abuse in the Catholic Church. The team won a Pulitzer Prize for public service in 2003. He's also the co-author of a book called Betrayal, Crisis in the Catholic Church. Michael has been praised by the Religious Communicators Council, which awarded him their top prize 4 years in a row for writing about religion in the secular media. Next to Michael is Monica Brady-Myroff, who is a correspondent at WBUR Radio, the best news radio station in Boston. She was the lead reporter, again, on the clergy sexual abuse scandal for WBR and had reported more than 200 stories on the issue. In 2002, she won an Associated Press Award for her report on Cardinal Laud's resignation. She has also worked as a radio journalist in Kenya, Brazil, and Kosovo. Gustav Niebuhr is an associate professor of religion and media at Syracuse University, where he also directs the Religion and Society program, and also directs the Carnegie Program in Religion and Media. Over a 20-year career in journalism, most recently at the New York Times, and prior to that at the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, and the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Niebuhr has established a reputation as a leading writer about American religion. He's working on a book about religious pluralism and interfaith relations in America. And finally, and importantly, most importantly, Hannah Rosen, who is the author of a book called Guards Harvard, which was based on an article in the New Yorker. And that book will come out in September. She was also the book is about the next generations of evangelicals, and it's, as I said, it's due out in the fall. She is a staff writer, although now she's on book leave at the Washington Post and has written about politics and culture. And she was, for several years, the Post's main religious writer. So let's begin with Michael.
These technologies. So we were asked to offer some personal reflections on our own journalistic odysseys. I actually grew up about 3 miles from where you're all seated right now. for sale if any of you need a place to live. And as journalists are trying to reinvent themselves, I've been trying to learn a little about filmmaking. We're making a documentary about this house, and it turns out that the house was built in the late 19th century for a theologian, a professor at Newton Theological Seminary, which is now Andover Newton. His name is Charles Rufus Brown. And then in 1966, when my parents bought the house, I later learned they bought it from a guy named George Collins, whose claim to fame was that he was the religion reporter for the Boston Globe. So I'm not sure I can claim religion was in my blood the way it was in Gus's, but I don't know, maybe some of you believe in predestination. I actually began my career covering politics and government here in Massachusetts on the South Shore for the Patriot Ledger, and then covered government in Texas and in Washington State and in Washington, D.C. when the Globe asked me to come home and cover religion at the start of the year 2000. So it's been 7 years now, and it's been a busy enough 7 years that we don't have all that much chance to step back and do the kind of thinking that BC and Eastern Nazarene have asked us to do today. So I'm glad to have a chance to talk with you about some of the tensions that are inherent in the work of being a religion reporter at a large metropolitan newspaper in this country. We were asked to think about some of the tensions that are present in reporting on religion. And I guess, as I think about that question, I think there are two kinds of tensions that I face on a regular basis. One involves tone, and the other involves substance. When I talk about tone, I think, particularly in the coverage of religion in American newspapers, there's a tension between respect and deference. Clearly, religion still, at American newspapers, is accorded a level of respect that attaches to almost no other constituency within our culture. There's a marked contrast in the expectations, I think, at most newspapers for the way that religious institutions and people of faith are characterized, and the way, say, politicians and people of particular political views are described. In political coverage, there's often a strong appetite for irreverence and for a level of critical thinking that discomforts people frequently when we're talking about religion. On the other hand, there has traditionally been a level of deference accorded religious institutions in our culture by the news media that has substantially eroded over the last, say, 15 years, and particularly in the wake of the clergy sex abuse crisis that began here in Boston. I think newspapers, including my own, have come to the conclusion that religious institutions are significant enough players in our culture, in our political lives, in our civic lives, that they deserve and need, and they deserve and need the kind of scrutiny that journalism has traditionally provided to other major institutions in our culture, and that scrutiny can't be provided by journalists without the kind of bias that is often feared when people begin to talk critically about religion. When I think about the tension in substance, I think the central tension for those of us who cover religion is between coverage of what I suppose you in academia would call lived religion and coverage of more traditional institutional news. When I was talking to the Globe about coming to work here in the summer of 99, the editors who were looking to hire a religion reporter made it quite clear that they were trying to avoid the kind of institutional coverage that they believed had characterized much religion reporting in this country in the previous few decades. And that meant they wanted less and less coverage of denominational infighting, debates about prayer book revisions, stories about retirements of clergy and that kind of thing. And they wanted more and more stories about the role that faith and spirituality were playing in the lives of our readers, people who live in eastern Massachusetts. And indeed, that's how I began my career at the Globe, writing stories about trends that we were seeing in the way faith was playing out in this region. But over time, the nature of the job has has changed fairly dramatically. First, because of September 11th in 2001, which was my second year at the Globe. September 11th, of course, was a huge event in our society, and for religion reporters, it demanded for many of us a rapid immersion in Islam, which many of us had written very little about previously. There were lots of stories that fall. Firstly, about the alleged return to faith practices by many Americans, and secondly, about the role of Islam in the United States, the civil liberties and kind of potential discrimination issues that were raised in the immediate aftermath of September 11th, and then in the relationship between terrorism and Islam that has been the subject of much discussion ever since. And then here in Boston, just a few months later, the clergy sex abuse crisis erupted with reports in my paper about the Archdiocese of Boston's handling of sexually abusive priests. And again, the scandal that erupted as a result demanded a level of attention to religious institutions and a kind of almost traditional coverage that could not have been anticipated when we began. I can see I'm already halfway through here, and I haven't begun my fabulous slideshow. We were asked also to think about whether stories that are detrimental to specific religious groups should be altered to consider the human costs of destroyed careers or social standing. And as we think about that question, I think it's important to think about what exactly do we mean by detrimental? Who is it that we might be protecting? And, you know, when you think particularly, and I'm going to run through some images of pages in the Globe, but when you think about the coverage of controversy, I think it's important to remember that it's debatable whether coverage such as the sexual abuse crisis in the Catholic Church was in fact detrimental to the Catholic Church itself. Let me show you some examples, and then I'll keep talking as I do. The clergy sex abuse crisis began with this report on January 6th, and I realize you can't read the content, January 6th of 2002 in the Globe. It was inspired, actually, by a case, and this one you really won't be able to see, but on page 42 of the Boston Globe, about 10 years earlier, had appeared the first story about a priest named John Gagan. There had been plenty of publicity in this country about allegations of sexual abuse by Catholic priests, and there had been plenty of attention in the Globe to individual cases, including a fairly spectacular case involving a serial pedophile in southeastern Massachusetts in the early 90s. But what changed in Massachusetts in early 2002 was that the Globe was able to get access to large amounts of documents that demonstrated that the Archdiocese of Boston had known about allegations against priests and failed to remove them from jobs in which they had access to children. And they had done this repeatedly. And, you know, as we look at the coverage of the abuse crisis, it became a huge story. This is Cardinal Law at his first news conference a couple days after the first Globe story. Some of you may remember that the Archdiocese of Boston at first chose not to respond at all to the Globe's questions about its handling of a priest named John Gagan. But the firestorm that erupted was so enormous that they decided they had to engage. It became a huge news event, with Cardinal Law often facing very difficult questions. This is his press secretary. There was a stakeout. This all took place right across the street from where we're seated, property that once belonged to the Archdiocese of Boston, that Boston College actually acquired as a result of the Archdiocese's need for money to settle the abuse cases. And for more than a year, there was a stakeout just outside the Chancery grounds where Monica and I were both there through snow and heat and whatever. There were protesters who would surround news conferences. This is the Cardinal's press secretary, Donna Morrissey. And a year into the crisis, on December 13th of that year, Cardinal Law summoned us all to a room in one of the buildings across the street and announced that the Pope had accepted his resignation. We actually published an extra that day, which is, we've only done that twice in the entire time I've been at the Globe. But when I think about whether or not this is detrimental, I mean, there are a lot of ways. I can't imagine that any of you actually believe that this crisis was detrimental to the Catholic Church fundamentally, but I, if you do, I point you to this quote from Pope John Paul II, who said in April of 2002, "We must be confident that this time of trial will bring a purification of the entire Catholic community, a purification that is urgently needed." We've tried to acknowledge in our coverage that although the coverage of sexual abuse was necessary and important, and we believe valuable, and many of our Catholic readers believe valuable, and of course the vast majority of our readers are Catholic, at least by birth, if not by practice. We've tried to make sure that we've been attentive to other developments in the Catholic Church, and that means that we've covered the ceremonial. This is the new Archbishop of Boston, Sean O'Malley, becoming a cardinal. And of course, the death of the Pope, and the controversial, even beyond the crisis, the Archdiocese of Boston has had a number of very difficult issues to face in the wake of the crisis. It has been closing large numbers of parishes and small numbers of schools, and in this case, the Archdiocese actually did a surprise closing of an elementary school, locking out kindergartners and first graders to prevent what they thought was going to be a takeover of the school building by the children's parents. And again, in coverage of this story, some people might say this is a negative story, some people might say this is detrimental to the Catholic Church, but to the Catholic families, children, and parents who loved this school that they were locked out of, I think they would see the coverage in a different way. I'm already running out of time, so I'm going to run very quickly through some examples in some other denominations and other faiths. The Episcopal Church, locally and nationally, has been consumed by a controversy that was at least exacerbated, if not began, with the decision of the Diocese of New Hampshire, which the Globe considers part of its territory, to elect an openly gay priest as its bishop. This is Gene Robinson facing the news media. Huge amount of public interest in his election. These are people who couldn't get into an event at which he was speaking, watching. This is his ultimate consecration as a bishop, which was attended by so many people in such a small state that it had to be held in a hockey arena at the University of New Hampshire. And actually, one of those people, I don't know which, is the police chief of Durham, New Hampshire, who dressed in vestments to go undercover to protect the bishop at the consecration. The way we've tried to contextualize, though, and explain this crisis, I think, says a lot about how we think about balance in the coverage of religion. The Globe is located here in the Diocese of Massachusetts, which is one of the most liberal dioceses in the Episcopal Church. There's almost universal consensus that the presence of a gay bishop in the Episcopal Church is okay. And of course, same-sex marriage is now legal here. I went, in order to explain to my readers what the controversy was all about, I went south. To South Carolina to find a diocese where the debate was almost the inverse of what it was here, and spent a week with parishioners in a very large, successful Episcopal parish talking about why they were so concerned about what had happened in New Hampshire and in their church locally. I'm going to move very quickly here. I'm going to skip these. This is the Bishop of Massachusetts. I think we'll talk a little bit about our coverage of global terrorism, which of course was accelerated by the terrorist attacks of September 11th. This is the Globe's front page on September 12th, 2001. And again, in an effort to provide some kind of balance and context, at the bottom of this page you can see we did very quickly a three-part series reported from numerous countries around the world about the forces of moderation in Islam and about the debate that was going on within Islam in predominantly Muslim countries about the future of Islam. Finally, I want to talk very quickly about some of the changes and pressures in journalism today, some of which Dr. Haynes talked about this morning. We are already at a point where roughly half of the people who read the Globe now read it online. Probably 800,000 people now read a copy of the print paper every day, and maybe 650,000 read it online. So we are approaching the tipping point, and we are very rapidly trying to understand understand what that means for us and to move our journalism to the internet. So the abuse crisis clearly was fueled by lots of readers on the web. I've been encouraged to blog. I was blogging with Cardinal O'Malley when he went to Rome. We've been doing all kinds of audio and video. I did a story a couple weeks ago about a Unitarian Universalist minister who advises women clergy about pulpit fashion. And here we have her talking about her special ministry. And we actually did an interactive graphic in which you can dress the clergy member and hear this minister critique your choices. And finally, of course, and again, this was alluded to this morning, as you all sort of talk about the various critiques of what we do, you should be aware that we're under tremendous pressure economically, and religion reporting is suffering as a result. Again, as Dr. Haynes suggested this morning, the best religion section in the country, that of the Dallas Morning News, has been eliminated. Lots of papers are cutting back on resources generally, and that means religion coverage is hurting as well. At the Globe, we've had two religion reporters for the last few years, and one of them left as a result of a buyout 2 days ago. The Globe has been losing both subscribers and advertisers. There's been lots of talk about it potentially being sold. And, you know, we just went through the third round of staff cutbacks in the 7 years that I've been there. So we're in a very challenging environment. We are subject to a level of scrutiny that is unprecedented, I think, in the history of journalism as a result of blogs and the sort of international, the fact that our journalism is available to everyone and that anyone can critique it very easily and spread their critiques because of the internet. I think that we are societally facing a tremendous amount of tension over how much we want to know about events that upset us and how much we want to know about points of view with which we disagree. We often hear from people demanding fairness who, in fact, seemed really to define fairness as more attention to their own points of view. And we're under tremendous economic pressures in the industry as a whole right now. I'm going to stop there and let Monica talk to you. Thanks.
Monica gets up here, I'd like both Michael and the rest of the panel to deal with the question that if you've lived in Boston at any length of time since the days of busing, the attitude was that the Globe was anti-Catholic, and maybe they can incorporate that in their comments.
Thank you very much for inviting me here today. Our newsroom is small, and at the time I joined it about 8 years ago, nobody had a beat. And now we have a few more specific reporters, but I'm still somebody, general assignment reporter. So I cover a broad range of social issues, housing, welfare, education, media, to name a few, and religion. And, you know, I'd like to say that my coverage of religion was well planned due to my background and my expertise in the subject, but to be honest, the reality was when September 11th happened, I was on maternity leave. And I was also out of town, so had I actually been here, I'm sure I would have come back into the newsroom and worked, but I was out of town and remained there for a while because I couldn't get home. And when I came back on January 1 of 2002, the first story on my plate was Father Gagin's trial. And everybody else in the newsroom was just exhausted and burnt out, and they needed somebody to cover it, so I covered the trial. And that opened up a door of 5 years of intense religious reporting that I had not anticipated, but had truly enjoyed. And what I brought in my audio presentation will take you back there, as Michael's did. Mine is the audio. I just should have played it along with your photos, really, because a lot of it goes right with the pictures you just saw. It's just a brief 2 minutes to sort of bring you back to that time, because I'd like to talk about why I think, as a reporter, the whole scandal erupted and is broken by the Globe, and I'd love to have a dialogue too with Michael about his thoughts on it.
After years of silence on the issue, Cardinal Bernard Law invited the press into his home yesterday to make an unprecedented apology to minors who've been sexually abused by priests. He also pledged zero tolerance for such behavior.
Any priest known to have sexually abused a minor simply will not function as a priest in any way in this archdiocese.
The alleged victim in this case, Eric McLeish, says these writings should have alerted the church.
These are the writings of a perverted monster who was sent out into the field, unsupervised, to be with alienated youth, with children. We had war warnings about it in 1977, 1979, 1983, 1982, and what happened?
But the smoking gun appears to be in Cardinal Law's hand. In 1990, when Shanley's personnel file was already bulging with complaints, Cardinal Law assured a parish in California Shanley was a priest in, quote, good standing and should be allowed to minister. And in 1996, while the word from the Vatican was fairly brief and it just said that he has resigned as Archbishop of Boston, not as a cardinal, but as the head of the Boston Archdiocese, and that he will be replaced...
I will go on retreat to the monastery. Following that, I will take up residence outside the Archdiocese and continue my responsibilities as cardinal. Needless to say, I will continue to be available as necessary in the legal process.
The school year always ends with a mass, says 9-year-old Sean Sullivan, except for this year.
It's not going to be a completed year.
This year ended with a quickly put-together ceremony in nearby Oak Square Park for the kindergarten day in and out. The video podcasts are called the Cardinal Cast. He's done 9 since Christmas, but has stepped up his internet broadcasts now during Lent. In this one, downloaded from iCatholic.com, O'Malley says most Catholics take the wrong approach, using Lent as a time to lose weight or abstain from chocolate.
Then our Lent will have been wasted if we have not used this as a time to renew our love for the Lord, our relationship with Him, to take more time for prayer and for charity in our life.
The cardinal is dressed as he always is.
So that was obviously the last one was just a story I did recently on the cardinal podcasting because I had since the clergy news scandal I've done a lot of other religion stories and that was one of them. But they tend to be focused on religion as a business, religion as a social issue or a conflict, honestly, and that the faith issues. I've touched on some, and I always try to get at them in my reporting because I think that's what interests me. That's what's human about them. That's what people can identify with. But they're harder to get at. And from my standpoint, I feel like religion reporting reporting on religion critically really exploded 5 years ago, and I see it as sort of a conflagration of 3 major factors: the Boston Globe asking the courts for these documents that showed what was going on in the Catholic Church, and that came with a change in leadership with Marty Baron, and I've always wondered how much he influenced things. He wasn't from Boston. He didn't have the connections in town like other people. He saw this as just a story that needed to be told, but then the courts did acquiesce and release all those papers that you heard a little bit about the documents, courts that I think as well have shown deference to the church in the past. And then politicians like Tom Riley really coming down hard on a religion that he grew up with and he struggled with. And that was a really interesting point to me, too, to watch him struggle with his own religion and to be critical of it and consider, legal action against Cardinal Law. As a reporter covering religion, I'm often worried about how the religion will react to my coverage. Because especially when it's Catholic, this was before the clergy abuse scandal, but in a predominantly Catholic audience, you're reporting on a religion that is so close to people's hearts, and that religion is something that there are no list of numbers and statistics to point to and make your point. And journalists tend to go for where the hard facts are, and religion is so much, when you get to the faith issues, they're so, they're personal, they're just personal, and people... there's just a sense in me of concern of offending somebody when covering a religion that I'm not familiar with, honestly. But I try to take an interesting look at, I try to take a look at it in any event, but it just raises a little level of concern. Another area he asked me to touch on was reporting on Islam and global terrorism. And post 9/11, we have done a lot more reporting on Islam as a religion, but also that's tend to focus on conflict, the conflict over the mosque in Boston, in Roxbury, and some profiles of Muslims in the area post 9/11, trying to humanize it. I've actually tried to do more humanizing of Islam in the sense that I was starting to work on a story about Eid, the celebration at the end of Ramadan, to just have just a sound story, just a sound portrait of what does it sound like when people break the fast. I've tried to think a little bit more about religions. It doesn't always have to be conflict. It doesn't have to be right at their faith. It's just that this is what people do. Here are people in our society celebrating their religion, and this is what it sounds like. We do it for other religions, and we hadn't done it for Islam. So I was prepared to do that, and then news broke, and I couldn't do it this year. So next year I'll do my Eid al-Fitr celebration. As we mentioned, I also lived and reported in Kenya and Brazil, traveled to Kosovo, and I covered religion a lot in Brazil. I used to work for Vatican Radio. So every time the Pope did anything or said anything about Latin America, I covered it. But that I didn't feel was critical at all. That had to be, you know, they wanted it all to be positive. So that was kind of a little strange. So a little bit about my own personal background is I am Catholic. I was raised Catholic. I married a Jew. And I know a lot about Judaism now because we celebrate Jewish holidays and with his family. And I also studied Islam in college when I was living in Kenya, on the coast of Kenya, and did a research paper on Ramadan, fasted, and know a lot about Islam. So I kind of feel like I get that. It helps. But one thing I find interesting, and I don't know if this happens to Michael a lot, but I cover a lot of different types of stories. When I cover a religion story, people often ask me what religion I am. And yet when I'm covering a story about education, they don't ask me whether I went to public school or private school, or did you go to a pilot or a charter, or healthcare, or are you a Blue Cross or Blue Shield? Nobody asks those personal questions about religion. But I think that speaks a lot to how people feel about religion, that it's theirs, and unless you're a part of it, you can't understand it, you can't identify with it, you'll get it wrong. And I just found that as sort of an interesting social point. So thank you very much. And
good stuff.
Thank you. I should acknowledge my pleasure at being on a panel with Michael Paulson and Hannah Rosen and Monica Brady Meyeroff. Michael and Hannah were colleagues that I often saw at news events, including the penultimate reporting experience I had at the New York Times, which was the Catholic Bishops Conference in the fall of 2001. As Monica is someone I've enjoyed listening to, either when I've been in Boston or just listening to NPR in the wider world. In terms of personal background, I'm a hometown boy. I grew up in Arlington. And I try to say that carefully so that I don't say Arlington, which is, of course, the natural tendency of anybody who grew up there. And I'm a little bit surprised, given the part of our subject, that no one has really mentioned it, the close proximity that we have here to perhaps the greatest religious shrine of all time, and certainly in America, and that is Fenway Park. I have been there many times. I have eaten of their bread, and I have consumed their beverages, and there is simply no other experience in the world like that. I feel uplifted, generally. We could talk about 2004, but I won't. One thing I do want to point out before I get going, and I am cognizant of having about 10 minutes, but I both like and I'm somewhat amused by the design, visual design for this conference here. If we look back at it here, it's very nice type and layout, but I deal generally with 18, 19, 20, 21-year-olds, and I'm not sure if they would know what that is right there. I remember them. I learned on one of those, but one doesn't see them very often these days. The theme for my 10 minutes is really about being on borders, and that's how I have thought of myself throughout much of my professional life. I did not start out by any means with the goal of covering religion. My goal when I began in journalism in 1980 was to work my way up to a political beat. And I started at a small newspaper in Western Massachusetts, which then was an independent and had a great reputation, and now is not an independent and does not have a great reputation, so I won't name it. But my second paper after that was the Times-Picayune in New Orleans. I went down to cover politics, specifically to cover politics in Louisiana, which is an experience in and of itself, and was in some ways rather amazing because one could do investigations as reporters are supposed to do and see absolutely nothing happen as a result of those investigations from local officials. But it was while I was in Louisiana that I got a phone call from a friend of mine at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, a friend who was a general assignment reporter, and he said, they're opening up a religion beat here. They have an older woman who does the church page and the church notes, and that's not it. They want to get religion into the news. Now, believe it or not, I had never in my entire life thought of doing religion as a news subject. I just never had. I saw very little news writing about religion, and I found it anyway interesting. But it was within that five-minute conversation that I realized that was exactly what I wanted to do. And so I began an all-out campaign that lasted nearly a year to convince the people of the Constitution to hire me. And eventually they got so sick of me calling and writing letters and even showing up in person that they did hire me. And it was a wonderful, fortuitous thing because I was then on to a subject that occupied me for the next 16 years until about the end of the year 2001 when I left the New York Times. Four points here, and let me run through them. One is more personal, and it has to do with being hopeful. Two, the second point, it's sort of, if I had to title it, it has to do with the paradox of American religion, a paradox within American religion. Three, blasphemy, and four, dealing with blasphemy. Okay, the first, hopeful. When I started on covering religion, I saw myself as being something of an interpreter, and I don't mean in any way to sound arrogant in saying that, but I saw an opportunity to sort of stand on a borderline that is the so-called secular press and write about religious institutions and individuals, reflect them back to them and also to people who were not religious, or at least didn't think they were religious. Some of the most profoundly religious people I've ever met are people who say up front, I am not religious. Indeed, they are. They just don't recognize it as what happened to them when they were 13 and confirmed or went through a bar mitzvah. But I thought, and I still think, that it's that religion in the United States, in all its great variety, is an enormously rich and undercovered subject. And to have the privilege to write about it and was something that was absolutely terrific. And it left me with just a vast, vast host of stories. Now, in some ways, I predate, in my experience, some of the other people on the panel. I started in 1986. I wrapped it up in 2001. And after that, I moved on as into academia. Now I'm at Syracuse University, where I hold the position of Associate Professor of Religion and the Media, again on a border, because I straddle two colleges, the College of Arts and Sciences, where I'm in the Religion Department, and the Newhouse School of Communications, where I also teach. People ask me what I teach. I teach a course in American Religions, and I teach also reporting courses, and head up a new program, which I did not originate, called Religion and Society, which is to bring together all the faculty members who have an academic interest in religion, bring them together as a community, and undergraduates can major in that, going across departmental lines. I've created a new minor called Religion and Media. Again, a sort of a border crossing experience. It's aimed at journalism students in particular, hoping to expose them to academic courses, which would then inform academic courses in religion that would inform their writing, their broadcasting, in years to come, and hoping not necessarily to create specialists, but simply educated generalists, which we need so badly. As I do this, the Newhouse School of Communications, 5 minutes, is building a new building. On that building, they have got a big window, and on that window is inscribed the First Amendment. The building will be dedicated in September, and so religion and free speech are joined there in several foot-high letters. I think that's very important because it shows how much in the mainstream one way or another, religion is in the United States. And one of the great problems in journalism has been to try to break religion out of the box that it was put in by senior journalists and editors for so long and show it as an interwoven part of American society. But to get to my second point, both the beauty and the problem of religion in America is how extraordinarily diverse it is. And I tell my students, I tell them that what they ought to do is read William James's varieties of religious experience, and then they sort of get at certain basic truths about American religion, if only in the title. And that is how remarkably individualistic religious belief and experience are in this country. And James also, one of the wonderful things about that book is one of the chapter titles, which James talks about the reality of the unseen. It's one of those things that makes religion very elusive in some ways, coverage, and yet at the same time so real. We are talking about people's experiences. We are talking about the values to which people assign certain things that are extremely important in their lives. We live amidst symbol systems that orient us in one way or another. And it is because there are certain objects that are real in a superficial sense, but also are real in another sense that creates so much of the problem. And I think gets to our issue of blasphemy. An attack, for example, on the Quran is an attack on a book for non-Muslims, but it is an attack on Islam itself for Muslims. The burning of an American flag may seem to be somebody exercising a right of free expression, but for other people, it's a direct attack on America itself. And part of the real challenge of sort of interpreting religion is understanding the symbol systems, I think, and the realities, these sort of invisible facts in one way or another. Which brings me to my fourth point, and that is dealing with blasphemy, if you want to call that blasphemy, the assault on symbols. And that is, there are people, we acknowledge, who do and say hateful things. And there was an example of that at a university campus, which shall go unnamed, a year and a half ago, a very vivid example in which students put up on a website a photograph of a lynching, a historic photograph of a lynching of two African Americans, and made a joke about it. Not a directly racist joke, but a joke that clearly was terribly inappropriate, and the campus blew up. But some people didn't quite understand what was going on. There was the historical fact of the photo, but there was also the fact that the photo functioned as a symbol. It functioned as a deep, deep symbol for a large number of students on the campus. And the problem was what ensued later was a discussion about free speech and whether anything like that should be shown. In some ways, one of the great problems, I think, of dealing with blasphemy or attack on sacred symbols is the response that they're recorded. And it makes me think that there are basically, that I have a problem, even as a journalist, with the idea that's often thrown out of speech answering speech, because I think there are different levels of speech. And hate speech, hateful attacks, qualify as something quite different in my mind than simple speech. And in this way, I draw some inspiration from the political philosopher Amy Gutman, who is now president of the University of Pennsylvania, that there is an enormous spectrum of discourse in the United States that is legally protected. But there is a slightly narrower spectrum that constitutes serious speech. And that when one gets outside of that, into attacks on symbols, and into hate speech, then one has to recognize that for what that is. And that may merit nothing more than simple condemnation. And then we move on. But in that case, there are different levels, I think, of speech as a response to various provocation. In any case, I'll wrap it up here.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for your patience for the last speaker. I'm going to talk about evangelicals because I've just finished writing a book on this subject, so I'll talk primarily about that. That's what I wrote about a lot at the Washington Post. When I saw the word blasphemy brought up as a topic, I had to remind myself that there are places, you know, there were just news about Afghanistan and Hamid Karzai putting two reporters in jail for blasphemy, and then the news about the French trial came out. And there are places in this world where if you're a reporter covering a religion, you have to be extremely careful about what you say. So we should put that in context. Blasphemy in America has a kind of different connotation. You know, it's something that we use as headline a lot. Somebody said something blasphemous. You know, the Rolling Stone magazine is blasphemous because it puts a picture of a rapper on its cover with a crown of thorns. Or, you know, Madonna is blasphemous when she talks about a certain mystical Jewish prophet in one of her songs. But, in fact, it doesn't have the legal power that it does in other countries to say that something is blasphemous. And I was recently reading about the history of Hollywood censorship, in which I came across news, the famous case of the Catholic Church trying to ban Roberto Rossellini's film about the peasant woman who believed herself to be the Virgin Mary. And the conclusion of the Supreme Court in that case was, it is not the business of government in our nation to suppress real or imagined attacks upon a particular religious doctrine. And it's after that, what happened is it became sort of what Charles Haynes called the glorious mess. And that's the experience of it is at a newspaper where you know, everybody has the right to come and speak to the newspaper, and the newspaper has the right to make editorial decisions, but basically, if the government is out of the picture, it becomes a judgment call. It's no longer, can we print this the way it is in France, you know, will I be fined or will I go to jail? It's sort of, should I print this story, or should I say this about the Catholic Church or an imam or whatever religious story I'm deciding about? And in my experience, it's an inherently fraught relationship between the newspaper and religion, because the newspaper is about airing several points of view. That's what a newspaper story does. And a religion believes that it has the monopoly on truth. So merely by writing about something in a newspaper format, it is inherently insulting and easy to offend. And something like, you know, gay marriage is a perfect example. Just by including several points of view, you've offended everybody in some way in those points of view. So it's something that the newspaper, I recall having dealt with a lot. Now, Christians are, and evangelicals in particular, you know, just type in the word to the computer, you know, Christians offended newspaper. I mean, they're famous for feeling and offended by the newspaper, and, you know, there's many arguments to support this, the percentage of reporters in, you know, big city newspapers that are Democrats, the percentage that are religious, which is changing day to day. There are more religious people working at newspapers, but they do complain often about being unfairly portrayed in the mainstream media. That's what we have Fox News for. But, I mean, there's now a lot of conservative institutions to take care of that, but let's just say it's true. And I have little room to speak here because I come from the newspaper which famously did the greatest, you know, insult to evangelicals, calling them, I think it's poor, uneducated, and easy to command. And I actually think it was Mike Isikoff. I meant to look it up before I came here. It was mentioned earlier. And that was only in 1992, and I recently looked up all the coverage of evangelicals in 1992 because there was a Virginia governor's race. That's when politicians really started actively quoting the Bible and running for office as, you know, Bible-quoting politicians. And it's quite remarkable. It's not that long ago, and yet the language that the Washington Post uses to describe evangelicals, it's really as if they're sort of foreign, alien beasts. You know, the thing, so do you really think that, you know, you want this to be a theocracy? Is that what you're saying? I mean, the sort of editorial board questions make it seem like they, you know, never met such people before. And I have to say that I wasn't hired that early in the paper, but I'm sort of exhibit A in the ignorance of journalists when I took over the religion beat, because I had come from the New Republic, And I had written about this first generation of politicians as if they were aliens. I mean, they talked to me about end times and the apocalypse, and it's like, I just thought they were crazy, and I couldn't believe that somebody like that was elected to public office. It did not occur to me that many people, in fact, held these views and that they were pretty common, and so that's what happened. And it was a very steep learning curve for me. And within about 6 months of traveling the country and writing about evangelicals, I started to adopt what Gus called sort of the translator of religion argument. And I came to believe that if I sat down on an airplane and said to the person sitting next to me, so when did you accept Jesus Christ as your personal savior, that would be a completely natural conversation opener, you know, but it took me a few months to understand that that's America, and America was not the Washington Post newsroom, and I just didn't really realize it. And at the time, there was the Kansas school board was considering, in one of its many iterations of considering, how to reintroduce creationism into the school curriculum. And you know, every time this would come up, the newspaper would look at it and say, oh, it's a crazy thing. And I would say to the people at the Washington Post, you know, do you know how many Americans are creationists? I mean, broadly defined, do you understand that 82% of Americans are creationists? And narrowly defined, meaning the Earth is 6,000 years old, and, you know, it's something like 43%, and nobody believed me. So, I mean, nobody in the newsroom believed me. So I actually set this out as a task for myself and did a series of stories where I went out to Olathe, Kansas and talked to various people who were, you know, not crazy, very highly educated. One of them had been a fossil expert. A couple of them were scientists, and sort of did a series of profiles about people, at least trying to explain what is the enduring power of something like creationism, and why does it endure in very places which are symbols of progress, like, you know, exurbs, outer suburbs, places where people have money, places where people are educated and teach, and to just try and get that point across. I did the same thing about, I remember, Ken Starr's religion, where there were certain stereotypes out there about Ken Starr's religion, in which I pointed out that, in fact, you know, if you go to Ken Starr's church, it's incredibly New Age. I mean, you hear a lot of language that will sound familiar to you from, you know, 60s self-help groups. There's this support group and that support group, and it all sounds very modern. So I did, you know, so I wouldn't say that I was in sympathy, but you did realize that there is a vast nation out there which speaks like this, and that there's a way in which you have to translate this into mainstream newspapers. Then 9/11 came around, and I talked about this earlier. This was a very interesting experience for me because here the World Trade Center had just been bombed, and there was, you know, a lot of misunderstanding about what Islam is about and who's a Muslim and Wahhabism, and we were all kind of learning these words anew. And yet I found, as I said earlier, there was a greater sensitivity, I would say, at the newspaper to insulting Islam than there was to insulting Christians. I can say that honestly. I remember being in a news meeting and proposing several stories for the front page about Muslims, and it was, I would say, far more difficult to get the kinds of stories they would put on the front page about Muslims were stories about civil rights violations, about people being unfairly taken into custody. Unless somebody was an actual hijacker, and they would write about conflicts in local Virginia churches, but it was extremely difficult to if you wanted to write a story about an imam who had two different views in Virginia and was conflicted about what he thought about the hijackers, they were very wary about putting a story like that on the front page. And I'm not sure why I put that out there. I have several theories that, in fact, that there's such a great sensitivity to race, especially at the Washington Post. There have been really great problems they've had with race and writing about African Americans, and that has made them more sensitive when something has a cultural issue, whereas because Christians represent the large mainstream, they're not so sensitive to things like that. And again, it's not the way, whenever people write me letters or write me emails about why did I write this and that about a Christian institution, generally they have the sense that there's kind of a large monolith called the Washington Post, and that large monolith is biased against Christians or doesn't understand Christians, and it's really not like that. I think it's what a lot of the speakers have brought up today, that it's kind of a lack of knowledge in some ways. People just don't understand, and there's really just me and my story and maybe an editor who does or doesn't know something, but there is no monolith called the Washington Post that is biased against anyone. Now I'd like to fast forward a little bit to the last, let's say, 4 or 5 years after Bush won re-election, and this is now getting back to evangelicals. The picture changes quite a bit when you have a president who, you know, kind of embraces the evangelical community and calls Jesus Christ his favorite political philosopher. I didn't know Jesus Christ was a political philosopher, but so suddenly evangelicals start to feel like they really have a place at the table in American society, and they can no longer claim, you know, that they are kind of mainstreamed in a way. So theoretically they're put in a position of having to embrace free speech and free expression and a lot of the American ideals, but then practically lots of specific issues come up. And I want to talk about that new place a little bit, because my book is about the next generation of evangelicals and sort of how they deal with a lot of these issues of being mainstreamized. I'll bring up Hollywood first. Since the Passion of the Christ, it's more difficult for Christians to say we're not represented in Hollywood, they don't care about us. The Passion of the Christ was a sort of seminal moment in which suddenly there was a lot of attention paid to Christians, and in fact Hollywood became interested, as one producer told me when I wrote this story, didn't you know Christians were the new gays? Meaning that, you know, Christians is the next kind of subculture that we're interested in and going to pay a lot of attention to and going to try and reach out to and make a lot of movies about. And this has created a kind of conflicted moment, because these, you know, the movie, I don't know if any of you saw The Book of Daniel, which was this short-lived series on TV in which there was an actual figure, you know, usually they kind of make reference to God or reference to Jesus, but there was like an actual Jesus in this short-lived TV series who looked like a sort of Jesus of the 1950s headshots, who had, you know, sandy brown hair and, you know, talked to Daniel, who was a priest. And the show was written by a gay guy whose lover was Catholic. And, you know, it's like you sort of be careful what you wish for kind of problem is presented for evangelicals wanting to be, or Christians wanting to be better represented in television, because, you know, it brought up, basically at the dinner table, they only talked about gay rights. It was like the dinner table was the 1992 Republican convention. It was as if, like, a pastor's family would sit around all day and just talk about culture war issues all the time. And so, you know, here Hollywood was kind of trying its best to reach out to red state America, and this was the result. You sort of got a stereotype in a slightly different form. And then, you know, they tried again with the Nativity. I didn't actually see the Nativity, but it's a sort of sappy prequel to the Passion. And so it's a kind of, you know, it's a mixed bag what you get when you try and kind of dialogue and embrace the mainstream. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be understood all the time. Thank you. Now I want to move forward to this. This place that I have spent a lot of time and written about, as has Alan Wolfe, which is Patrick Henry College. Patrick Henry College is a college that explicitly set out to kind of place its graduates in political positions of power. It is a product of this moment of evangelicals trying to go mainstream and have a seat at the table. And it irritates a lot of people, especially a lot of evangelicals, because they feel like this school, and in my writing about it irritates people, because they feel like this school is kind of monopolizing the image of evangelicals as people kind of always hungry for power, and evangelicals are so much broader than that, and they represent so many more things than that, that they don't like the fact that Patrick Henry somehow speaks for evangelicals. Spending a lot of time in Patrick Henry College, you can see all the problems that these notions of free expression and blasphemy, all the problems that evangelicals are going to have in this new age where they're going to be part of the mainstream. Because, on one level, if you walk around Patrick Henry College and you go to a secular college, it will seem much more restrictive to you. There are many more things that people cannot say. I mean, they cannot curse. They certainly couldn't say anything about God or Jesus Christ. I mean, there's a lot more speech that would be unacceptable on a college campus and certainly in the college paper. They're alienated by the PC culture. I mean, they certainly would not, you know, they would mock all sorts of other places in which, you know, you had to include you know, transgender and everything. I mean, they would mock all that, but they themselves have their own restrictions, which are slightly different. In terms of the Patrick Henry newspaper, Baylor, which we did talk about at lunch, in 2004, the student newspaper, and Baylor is another university that's trying to kind of move forward and become a prominent institution of higher learning. And Baylor did, the students did endorse gay marriage, or at least say something positive about the idea of gay marriage in their newspaper, and the administration kind of freaked out, and nonetheless, they did get to say it, and they didn't ultimately shut down the newspaper. Now, such a thing would be unimaginable at a place like Patrick Henry. You could never imagine the students saying something positive about gay marriage. On the other hand, the great fear of these evangelical colleges is to be considered homophobic. And that's as much a fear almost as combating homosexuality. And this is something you see over and over again at evangelical colleges, which is just, you know, how can I do this? You know, on the one hand, I want to be part of this world and believe in free speech and believe that people can say whatever they want. And on the other hand, I just have a terrible fear that there's been many incidents at the college that people will, you know, see us as anti-gay or, you know, include us in the old school culture and some of the old stereotypes about evangelicals not liking homosexuals. So it is a dilemma for these colleges and for evangelicals in general who are trying to modernize, let's say. There's one other example I want to bring up. This has nothing to do with evangelicals, but it's just the most recent example I've seen of blasphemy and free speech, which is about Mormons, actually. Because of Mitt Romney's campaign presidential election, there's been a lot more writing about Mormons. And as opposed to Mormons just complaining about being unfairly portrayed in the media, this more touches on the issue of blasphemy. Every Mormon story you read nearly mentions the Mormon undergarments. And the Mormons, it's not merely that they think that the issue of the undergarments is unfairly portrayed. They actually think it's blasphemous to mention the undergarments because they think it's a sort of private issue. Yes, it is. But so the question is, a lot of newspapers and a lot of magazines have gotten letters saying, please don't mention them. You know, not just don't mention them, but don't. Yeah, it's unmentionable, basically. It's, blasphemous. Don't mention them. It's like a funny issue, and it's an issue of respect, and you know, it's not going to cause riots or anything. But basically, in every case, you know, the newspapers say sorry. In a way, I mean, the experience of writing about evangelicals and thinking about Mormons makes you, in some ways, think that the newspapers have the power. I mean, that in America, it's really the editors can make the decision. If they choose to publish a story, they can publish the story, and there's not much the religious institutions can do about it, so except complain. And so it is a kind of power that one should be conscious of. Thank you.
This discussion is so rich, and there's so many potential questions, so let's go right to the audience. Eric. As we wait for the microphone, let me put two other questions on the table for the panelists. One is the issue of the Globe and WBUR, and is the Globe anti-Catholic? And the other question is, does faith, the faith of journalists, what's the impact of your own faith, or lack thereof, on your coverage? Eric?
Well, I guess I'll pile on an extra one. I heard Charles Haynes earlier this morning say that 43% of Americans are willing to suggest that we should have restrictions on our speech, that we shouldn't be allowed to say things that might offend religious people. I hear Monica say that she's worried in reporting about offending people. I hear Gustav saying that he worries that speech doesn't meet speech properly. I hear Hannah saying that the Washington Post didn't adequately cover critical reflections on particular Muslims in the wake of 9/11, and so this brings a question to mind. You know, are we as a society too soft? Are we scared to talk about our deepest differences when we bring together a conference like this, or when we report on stories? Are we too sweetly Irenic in our conversations? Should we dig deeper? What are your reflections on that?
Hannah, do you want to begin?
Yeah, it is very interesting because I do feel like religion does have a separate place. I mean, they do. you know, there's, in one way, their newspapers are kind of don't know a lot of details about religion and religious history, but in another way, they just have this sense that, although it would be comparable to race, I would say, it has a comparable place to race, where people are, you know, every newspaper has, with the Boston Globe, it might be Catholics, because that's your local constituency, and in the Washington Post, you know, we might be extra sensitive about African-American coverage, but there are places where, you know, where there just is a kind of zone of quiet, and you have to be absolutely, really absolutely careful about what you say.
So is that appropriate, though, or is that, I mean, it may be, just
you know,
curious.
You know, with the Washington Post and race, it's been very controversial. I mean, there have been stories written by outside journalistic, you know, Columbia Journalism Review or a story in the New Republic once about the Washington Post avoiding, you know, many topics because of its fear of, you know, of offending people. So is it appropriate? I don't know. It's the American way, I guess. We don't have laws. We have, you know.
We have editors.
We have managers.
Gustav?
I guess I have to think about that. I zone quiet. That doesn't ring any bells, to be frank with me. And
well, you can pick up one of the other questions if you like.
All right, I don't think the Boston Globe or WBUR is anti-Catholic. And as far as personal religion goes, I think that's a matter of you know, that's something, you know, that's nobody's business, quite frankly, you know. And I never talk about that with anyone. So, that's what I have to say on that.
I always talk about it.
I don't talk, I mean, I avoid it, or I can, you know, with a name like Brady-Meyerov, I can sort of live in two worlds. But I don't share my actual deepest faith beliefs about it, but I'll say I was brought up a Catholic if it helps me to identify with them. But I don't think it's any of their business either. What I was saying is it's interesting to me that I get asked about it. I just asked Michael. He said he gets asked about it too, and I don't get asked about it in other stories. Now, with regards to why we're not, you know, are we avoiding religion as an issue, I think that media reflects society, at least we try to, and I think society avoids looking at religion as an issue to a large degree as well. Steve Prochera's new book about teaching religions makes you realize how little we all know about it and how little it's discussed in schools and homes beyond what you are brought up in your religion. So it's like we've grown this entire society that doesn't know how to discuss religion. So me as a reporter, too, feels like I'm a little, I have concerns about addressing it because I'm not sure I'm going to get it right. And yet my editor doesn't know any more than I do, and they didn't take religion. It's just, I think we're reflecting society, honestly, that we don't have a lot of open dialogues about religion.
When my mother went off to Bryn Mawr as an undergraduate, her father told her that there were three subjects she should be very careful not to get into discussions about, and they, of course, were sex, politics, and religion. And I think religion, for a lot of Americans, is viewed as a private matter. And there is a kind of, I think in part it stems from this sense of church-state separation that has so permeated our culture that we somehow think that that implies that there's a kind of everything religion separation, and we are sort of particularly uncomfortable in acknowledging the role that religion plays in so many people's motivations and values and daily lives. Newspapers and the news media in general have, over the last decade and a half, invested a lot more resources in coverage of religion, have tried to acknowledge the role that it plays in society, but absolutely we could do a lot better. And are we more sensitive to religion coverage than we are to other areas because of the baggage that comes with the way we have viewed religion in this society? Absolutely. To get to the question of is the Globe anti-Catholic, I mean, you know, I don't want to dismiss that lightly. There is certainly a strain of anti-Catholicism that has run through American culture. And there is a history of virulent anti-Catholicism here in Boston that we live with as part of our heritage. And the Globe was seen as an advocate of busing in the 1960s and 70s in Boston, when that was a very divisive issue, and I think that the issues of religion and class for many people were conflated. So the Globe was an advocate for busing. The people who were harmed were, who perceived themselves to be harmed by busing were white Irish Catholics who were working class. And I think they perceived the Globe as having abandoned them, and because their identity was so intertwined with their faith, they viewed the Globe as having abandoned Catholicism, even though the Catholic Church, at its highest levels, the cardinal at the time, was an advocate of busing. And that's the baggage that we live with at the Globe. It's certainly in the summer of 2001, as our investigative team launched onto looking into the history of clerical sexual abuse in the Catholic Church, we discussed this over and over and over again. We braced ourselves on January 6th of 2002 for massive protests that we expected from our predominantly Catholic readership over our decision to invest so much resources and so much space in clergy sexual abuse. And in fact, they did not appear. In fact, our Catholic readers egged us on to cover the issue more and more. We polled about this subject at least three times, asking our readers, asking Catholics in eastern Massachusetts whether they thought we had paid too much attention to the clergy abuse crisis, and repeatedly majorities of Catholics in this area said no. So I'm comfortable with where we wound up.
Some more questions? Is there one here?
Usually, many Muslims make a statement that the media distorted the image of Islam. I never make a statement. I usually say that the media should be sensitive in dealing with issues of Islam. So the question to whoever would like to respond, that observing how the media provided coverage about Muslims 15 years ago compared to present time coverage, how do you respond to this statement?
I would imagine there wasn't very much coverage of Islam 15 years ago, not a huge amount. And in a way, 9/11 is kind of a mixed blessing because there's so much knowledge was forced on. Suddenly everybody had to catch up to speed and engage with the local mosque that that was around, and immigration, the booming immigration story. I mean, I can speak from the D.C. area, that there was a great influx of immigrants that came into D.C. in the last 15 years. So there was a whole bunch of stories done about the mosques and the new Muslim communities, and so it's fairly new, I would say.
Well, I would say, at least from my perspective, that 15 years ago, it was not even on the map when you look at, the space we have to do reporting on the radio. But more recently, I still think it's not very well on the map for us, honestly, in terms of how we cover it. I think we cover the conflicts. We look at where the divisive points are, and we don't look at the faith or faith issues as much as we should be doing. So it's a little more, but I don't think it's good enough.
I guess I also can't go back 15 years, but I can go back 7, and I can tell you, obviously September 11th marked a dramatic turning point in the coverage of Islam in the American media, and not without good reason. Prior to September 11th, I can tell you from my own experience, the portrayal of Muslims in the Boston Globe was generally soft features, introducing people to communities that are living among us who are not well known. I remember myself, for example, doing a feature story about kids who were trying to memorize the entire Quran and the challenges of doing that here in a country in which they were growing up not speaking a word of Arabic. After September 11th, it was impossible to discuss the role of Islam without discussing terrorism. And that has, it just now permeates the discussion of how we cover Islam in our community. So as you well know, we now have a controversy over the construction of a mosque here in Boston that's sort of halfway underway, in which some of the board members are accused of having said things that suggested they might be sympathetic to terrorism or hostile to Jews. And it has become very difficult to separate sort of what happened on September 11th and what's happening in the Middle East and the whole global mess in which the world finds itself right now from coverage of this faith.
I can go back 15 years. At the risk of being self-referential, I got a front page story in the Atlanta Constitution, 1989, on Muslims in America. And in 1991, on the front of the Wall Street Journal. And at the same time, somebody got a front page story on front of USA Today, right around that time, too. I still remember it vividly. And the Washington Post and the Boston Globe were covering the construction of the new Islamic Center of New England around 1992. And there were other things as well. So there was coverage of Islam as a significant American community back in the late 80s and early 90s. I mean, it was going on in other places. The Los Angeles Times had coverage. The Chicago Tribune did too. It just, you have to have a historical memory in some ways for some of this. It's just that it did not come attached to an overriding story like 9/11. I mean, it's like evangelicals are always being rediscovered in the United States, and that's good. But they're being rediscovered in the 1980s, even though they had been discovered in the 1970s with the election of Jimmy Carter. And around 1960, Billy Graham's big crusades in Madison Square Garden and such. So these are ongoing stories, and we can sort of say, gee, you know, the media is not paying attention, but it pays attention in cycles. And in some ways, some of the dimensions of the stories change, but the subject remains there. I just have to say, too, there's been an awful lot of good religion reporting that's gone on through the decades. It's just that it shifts around in terms of where it's located to a degree. And I mean, when I came on the beat in 1986, I met people who had been very committed to religion reporting at some very prominent places in the 70s and in the 60s. And, you know, we can't forget events like the Second Vatican Council, which were covered exemplary. Length and depth and knowledge, and the same is true for other facets of American religious life.
Questions? Charles?
I had two things. One, an editor friend of mine said, when I asked him why he didn't publish the English cartoon, he said, well, you know, it would have been outside our policy. We have an understanding here of how we treat these kinds of things, and that would have would have violated our understanding, our shared understanding of this newspaper, what we do when it comes to such images and so forth. For any of you who were print newspapers at that time, is there such a kind of policy or understanding? Is it just was the decision not to publish them just that moment in time, or did it come in a larger context of this is how we handle these kinds of issues as they come up? And then Gus, I don't know if you want to say more about the answer, you know, instead of the bromide, the answer, bad speech is good speech. And I think it's good you push that a little bit and say, well, there's some speech that's so hateful, so out of bounds, that it's not enough just to say we respond to speech. Do you mean to suggest that there must be some legal way, some way that we carve out another category for unprotected speech under the First Amendment? Is that, in Europe, I mentioned Holocaust denial as being something that's carved out as unprotected speech. Is there something that should rise to that level, you think, in this country that should be, we should say, is not protected speech? Sorry to throw in two at once.
Oh, okay, take the second question first. No, I don't. I mean, well, wait, we've got to look. There are forms of speech that are not protected, right? Child pornography could be called a kind of speech. It's not protected. It's illegal. That's good. That's very, very good. And I'm not suggesting that with hate speech. I would not suggest that. But the one thing we haven't really talked about here, and I'm sort of stepping back and away from the journalistic perspective toward another perspective, and that is, I think that there's an obligation on behalf of everyone who values civil society to be able to call hate speech for what it is.
and not waste a lot of time on it, but just say, look, that is completely off the table, you know? And what I'm concerned about, as someone who's on a college campus right now, rather than a newspaper, is extreme speech being substituted for the right to free speech. And that does, and there are days where that happens, where the Nazis marching in Skokie comes to symbolize the right to free speech. And to me, that is, yeah, it's legally protected, but it does not symbolize for me the right to free speech. Free speech is much broader. It covers things that many of which uphold civil society. And I think that there's an obligation of the community just to call out things that are dangerous and that are very, very harmful, particularly when they're directed toward vulnerable groups. That's my opinion. But to censor it, no. I don't see any sort of change in law. I'm completely against that. So that's what I mean.
Yeah. The first question was about whether there are standards. There are not standards. I mean, there are a lot of standards about internal newsroom treatment. There are standards about sourcing in newspapers, and there are standards about, but there are not standards about offending in newspapers. That's all done kind of unofficially. The Danish cartoons was not a hard one, at least not for our newspaper, because there was no. On the other hand, they published that Abu Ghraib picture in the early days of the hooded, and that was published inside the newspaper before it became a big controversy. But because the Danish cartoons, you were reporting about some controversy that already happened, you could easily argue that there was no great news value in republishing those photos. And I think by the time that story got to the U.S., you had to have been explicitly trying to test a free speech, you know, trying to provoke by publishing those photos. So it wasn't that hard a case. You know, there was a huge discussion though about the Abu Ghraib photos and which ones to publish and which ones not. And that was an all night session of combing through those photos and picking three that were representative, but not horrifying. And in some cases, they made a compromise by publishing some on the web so that you actually had to choose to look at those photos if you wanted to, so you wouldn't have this out kind of to offend people. That was the compromise. And I think they ended up, going with three photos which were fairly muted, which weren't so explicit.
Michael, does the Globe have a standard?
Yeah, I guess, thinking back about the cartoons, I mean, Eric Severson said, I think this morning, it's just interesting to think about what would have happened if those cartoons had been produced by an American cartoonist. I mean, what would the Globe have done if we did not run them, but what would the Globe have done if they were drawn by the Globe's cartoonist and just handed in? I think the answer would have been different. I suspect we would have published them somewhat unknowingly. But as Hannah said, I mean, given that we were all able to watch what had happened in Europe, you would publish them now knowing that they would offend some fraction of local readers. And whether you didn't publish them out of fear that there would be rioting and violence or simply out of respect for your readers, the decision not to publish was fairly easy. Also, I think it has to be said, I mean, newspapers are now probably among the most prudish elements of American popular culture. We don't publish obscenity, we don't publish curse words, we still think of ourselves as a publication aimed at families. We're very sensitive to pictures of bloodshed and sexuality. I mean, I know this is going to be shocking to a lot of people, but we're very sensitive, particularly in visual images. So the decision not to run those cartoons is not particularly anomalous. I mean, we have somebody whose responsibility is to read the comics every day and make sure there's something in there that
we're trying to pass through. There's also what.
I'm sorry, but you did publish
some things.
Did you do all
the font cartoons? About the
Queer Sex Abuse
Crisis?
Yeah, they were.
I don't know whether we publish them or not, but certainly we publish regularly. I mean, regularly. We publish occasionally cartoons that some people view as anti-Catholic. And I would say, again, as Hannah said in her talk, that our we operate, I think, with a cultural presumption that because Christianity is dominant, that it can withstand a greater amount of scrutiny and satire than minority religions can.
Some more questions over there.
Michael, you started to refer to the pressures that are on newspapers in a changing environment and some of those business pressures. And I work with Protestant and Orthodox churches, and sometimes those are ones that are culturally acknowledged as being in decline. And so it strikes me there might actually be a parallel here, but as churches we understand wandering in the desert and maybe even sometimes resurrection. I'm wondering if the newspaper folks might be willing to talk about where you find hope in moving forward as participants in civic life and responsibility to report not just on religion but to continue reporting, and what might lie ahead for you in that.
I mean, I guess speaking just for myself, and we can all address this, I'm going to appeal at once both hopeful and apprehensive, and the reasons for apprehension are the incomplete implosion of the economic model of that has sustained the news media in this country for the last century, and the increasing polarization of our culture, so that I fear that many people no longer wish to consume news that even strives for something that we used to call objectivity, that people are increasingly looking for news that is suits their already determined political views. So those are the reasons for apprehension. The reasons for hope are that the internet, for all the sort of service that it has caused us, has dramatically increased our reach. And I mean, the number of people who read the content that the Globe produces has never been higher. They just don't pay for it. And you know, that's a problem, but it's also an opportunity. And there's a massive hunger for organizations that can distill information, and that's what we do. And I am hopeful that the appetite for news as a critical component of a thriving democracy is going to continue, and that we're going to find a way to make that economically viable.
Yeah, and there's also a specific thing that news, I mean, this is what I'm crossing my fingers for, there is a specific thing that newspapers do that blogs absolutely don't do and magazines don't do so well, which is, you know, which is investigations. I mean, which is sort of painstaking, many-person, long-term investigations into subjects of political import, whether they be, you know, National Security Council, phone tapping, Catholic abuse scandal. I mean, those are things that newspapers are uniquely suited to accomplish, and so that's, and it's quite difficult to maintain those in this atmosphere because, you know, for the Boston Globe now in its shrunken staff, or the Washington Post to dedicate, you know, six reporters to any one story, it has to be such a good story because, you know, the resources are just, they're just so much less than they used to be. So that's what, as newspaper people, you're trying to kind of hope, you know, keep stays alive in the new atmosphere.
Any other, one more question? We can take one more question. We have a question. I guess we don't. Well, I want to thank our panelists. Oh, did I miss one? Yes.
Hannah started to say that she does talk about her faith, and I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how that affects her.
I'm just not so disciplined. I mean, basically, it's forced on you. I mean, if you report on evangelicals, they could care less that you're a reporter. Like, you're a lost soul needing to be saved. So, you know, after someone hammers at me, and especially because I'm Jewish and I'm Israeli and my family comes from Israel, that's, like, so interesting to evangelicals. They just want to talk about it. And so, so I figure if I'm going to ask them, and then, you know, I have to say when I report on Muslims, it's the fact that I'm Israeli, which is interesting, and I do not have the discipline, nor I always just talk about it. I mean, it's a personal preference. I don't mind when people ask me, and I'm happy to tell them, and I feel like it's a different atmosphere than reporting about other subjects, because I'm asking them fairly intimate, personal questions about their beliefs, I can't talk to you. I reported in Israel for a long time for the Washington Post. I was there substituting for someone, and I did a lot of my reporting in the West Bank or in Gaza. And, you know, I find it impossible to be reporting to a Palestinian and not tell them that I'm Israeli or talk to them about where my family's from. It's hard for me to do. And for many reporters, they would rather not, because you're there doing your job, and it's not really about you, and that's a completely respectable position. I think it's a matter of, to me, it's a matter of preference and not ethics, but you know, maybe people disagree with that. It's just a preference.
Thank you, everybody, for coming. I want to thank our panelists this afternoon.